Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Unscrewed, the show that knows that real liberation includes sexual liberation. I am your host, Jacqueline Friedman, and welcome to a whole new season of Unscrewed. Boy, howdy, is there a lot of sexual culture to unscrew, is there not? But the thing that I am here to talk to you about this week is porn. And not just porn as a concept and sort of porn 101 and all that stuff, but you may have noticed that porn, the word porn and the idea of porn has been in the news a lot lately. And there's some good things about that, but also a lot of the discourse has been kind of troubling. So I called up my buddy Tina Horn, who is, of course, the host of the amazing podcast, Why Are People Into That? She is also the author of 2 nonfiction books, Love Not Given Lightly, and the succinctly named Sexting. Her writing has appeared like fucking everywhere. In fact, most recently, she has a big story out for Rolling Stone about how women are taking over the porn industry, relevant to our conversation. She is currently, and I think that I'm like breaking some news here. Is that right, Tina?
You are.
She's currently developing a science fiction series for a major comic book publisher. And she's an all-around smart woman. And I'm so glad to have her here to unpack all the porn bullshit. Tina, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me and breaking my tease, teasing my news. Thanks for teasing me, Jacqueline.
I will tease you anytime. I am so excited about the comic and I cannot wait to get it into my eyeballs.
I can't wait to put it there.
All right, so I feel like we've already gotten into the lightning round because like the first question is, what is making you happy this week?
Yeah, I was just telling Jacqueline before we started recording, I feel also like Unscrewed Nation will appreciate this story that like I had just had really hot sex and was like feeling great and then got a text, you know, from the person that I have been working with on this development deal, and it was very vague, but it was like, please call me, it's important. And so I called and I was like naked, you know, fuck drunk, like, you know, also maybe a little wine tipsy, like just like running around naked. Did I say naked already? Like sweaty.
You were funky, super like, funky naked.
Just like running around my apartment screaming. And it's funny because like you get like when you get really great news, it's like maybe part of you wants to get it when you're having a bad day so that it like lifts you up. But instead, I just like doubled down on the ecstasy. It was really great.
Amazing.
So, and that was last night. So I am like still pretty riding high.
That is amazing. Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
So what's the best sex advice you ever received?
You know, I recently got to interview Barbara Corrales, who wrote this book, Urban Tantra,
yeah,
that had a really big effect on me. And I think that Barbara Corrales really taught me the value of taking a really deep breath or many deep breaths during sex, whether it is kinky sex, and like especially if you are a masochist like me, and you enjoy receiving erotic pain, that breathing through that pain transforms the sensation, but also definitely true for more like pleasurable sensations that for many of us, we, you know, I think probably especially women, we think that we need to make our orgasms and our pleasure, even if when we're starting off masturbating and we don't want to be heard by our family or our roommates, that we make ourselves quiet and we hold our breaths and we try to become small, and that there's a lot of shame, like, and self-imposed shame wrapped up in that, and then we are not even thinking about it. So just like the value of, you know, and I have a lot of experience with yoga and meditation, so like I can bring a lot to that, but like everybody knows how to take a deep breath, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done. So and you know, like breathing deeply is free, and you know, a lot of us can do it. I mean, I'm asthmatic, so if I can do it, you can do it.
Awesome. What's been making you the maddest or saddest lately around the sexual culture?
I mean, honestly, it's what we're going to talk about today. Yeah. So if you want, we can...
We'll just table it.
We'll just table it.
So what is the biggest sex myth that you used to believe but don't believe anymore?
I definitely want to call back to something that I know that I have said on Unscrewed before, that I used to think that if I didn't have a certain kind of sex, that it was like a consolation prize, or just not, that I wasn't scoring, essentially. So I can think of like one relationship from my early 20s in particular where, you know, I was very sexually mismatched with my partner at the time, and we are really good friends now, and that feels really good to have figured out over the years what kind of relationship we should have. But I think I was also really unfair to him in my expectation that because I really identified so strongly as like a sex positive and sexually liberated person, that it was like it felt like he was compromising my identity by not wanting to have sex, or not wanting to have hours long super involved adventurous sex all the time, and you know, especially in long-term relationships, like, you know, masturbating next to each other, we should think of as sex. We should think, yeah, like, I masturbated next to my partner last night. We had sex last night, or I had sex last night. Like, and that, you know, or that oral sex, or that a quickie, whatever that means, or a spanking, or even like a really intimate, affectionate cuddling that is really present and conscious. Like, all of those things, like, our sex. And that, you know, I think that I used to believe that if I didn't have like a certain kind of like vigorous orgasm driven intercourse, frankly, that I like wasn't really having sex, and that used to cause me a lot of grief, and then I think I caused other people grief, and I'm really glad I don't think that anymore. And there's like so many more opportunities for satisfaction now that I've changed my framework about that.
Yes. Excellent. Okay. Last question in the lightning round. Who is one of the bravest people you can think of who's working to unscrew the sexual culture?
You know, I'm going to shout out my friend Jack the Stripper.
Yes.
So her name is Jacqueline Francis. So shout out to all my Jacqueline Fs.
Jacqueline Fs, woo!
And she goes by Jack the Stripper, like J-A-C-Q, the stripper. And she does so much. She is a very funny comedian. She is speaking of comic books, she's an incredibly talented comics writer. But so basically, like, her whole deal is she is a stripper. She's been a stripper for a long time. Oh, and she makes books. Literally, what doesn't Jack do? She also is like a really nice and fun person, which I can't, it's like not even fair. But she put together an amazing book called Striptastic, where she surveyed, I think, 300 strippers from around the world on all kinds of different topics. And then she illustrated this entire book, and which she crowdfunded and self-published. And I really think everyone should read it. I especially think sex workers and lovers of sex workers should read it. But definitely, if you have ever patronized a strip club, or if you enjoy patronizing strip clubs, or if you're a porn fan or anything like that, I think that you should read it. And even if you're none of those things, I think you should read it, because it is such a powerful tool of destigmatizing stereotypes and dehumanizing attitudes that we hold about sex workers in general, women in general, and strippers in particular. And her merch that she makes says things like strippers are people, and she also makes these amazing like hats and sweatshirts that say tip her, and a lot of her social media presence is just really she's just so direct and sincere, while also being hilarious and creative about how fucked up whorephobia is, and she's just like so amazing. So check her out. Shout out to Jack.
Hurrah. And we'll link to some of her stuff in the show notes at jacquelinefriedman.com. So you finished the lightning round. I would not say that we were very speedy, but
I am not speedy. I am not that.
But we did it. And now it's time for the main event, because so I want to start by talking about Stormy Daniels.
Please.
And I don't want to talk about the actual, what I see as the actual scandal, which is both the hypocrisy, right? This guy who like came to power on, you know, with the support of the evangelical right, which is always policing people's sex lives. And so like, I don't feel like the fact that he cheats on people is like actually that interesting. I do think it's a scandal in the sense of like, he's enabled by and continues to enable a lot of policing of other people's sex lives.
Totally.
And honestly, I mean, and this is like a weird tangent, but I'm not like mad about cheating. I think cheating is a consent violation, and I take it quite seriously.
Interesting.
I think cheating is a moral issue. I don't think polyamory or non-monogamy is a moral issue, but cheating is a moral issue.
Yeah, agreed.
But I don't want to talk about any of that. And I don't want to talk about the $130,000, which may have been an illegal campaign donation and all of that stuff. I think all those are real issues, and I wish that's all that was getting talked about. But what I keep hearing in this discourse about Stormy Daniels is porn star, porn star, porn star, porn star, porn star.
Right.
And in fact, it is not relevant that she is or is not a porn star. It's supposed to make it extra scandalous, right?
That's like, right.
And it's been like nagging at the back of my head, and I've had a lot of other shit on my mind, so I haven't really like properly like spoken or thought about it, but like it's driving me up a tree that this is like the scandal here is porn star and not all of the other things I just talked about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if I've actually thought about this until now, hearing you talk about it, but it's interesting because for 45, the fact that she is a porn star was a huge part of the appeal for 45.
Oh, sure. Yes.
Right? You know, and that doesn't negate anything that you said, but it's interesting to consider the fact that his impulse to, and this is, you know, obviously my analysis of his alleged behavior, speaking of sex being scoring, that he clearly is the kind of person who saw taking a porn star to bed as a status symbol.
As an accomplishment.
As something.
Or an acquisition.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and you know, which does seem to be one of his primary sexual motivators in life. So So it's interesting that, like, his impulse in that regard is kind of the same as the impulse of the way that it's being covered, which is that the fact that Stormy Daniels has made porn brings this scandal, it brings a salaciousness, it brings an extra level of dirty.
Yeah, I was literally just thinking the word dirty. Yeah. So I just want to talk about, like, the implications of the way this discourse rolls out. And I know that you wanted to talk about the tweets from Chelsea Handler and somebody else, I forget. And
sort Judd of Apatow.
Judd Apatow, whatever. Like,
whatever.
I'm a little whatever about him already. But the way the idea of a porn star being someone who is sort of dirty and base and sort of brings a new low to the whole proceedings, right? Somebody who's, like, set apart and othered, you know, how that idea is being used politically in this conversation.
So I have the tweet in front of me. As painful as it is, I will read it for folks who have not seen it yet. Chelsea Handler tweeted, "There is an entire generation of children whose, first of all, misspelled whose, I am not going to be the classist grammar police, but
except that you kind of are.
There is an entire generation of children whose first memory of their president is a man who supports child molesters, wife beaters, Russian hacking, and porn stars." And then she goes on to say, "We have a moral obligation and responsibility to blah, blah, blah." Yeah. So
like, which of these things is not like the fucking other?
Yeah, man. And I mean, people really came for her, which is, you know, on Twitter, which is good. Maybe it changed her perspective or gave her pause.
Did she respond?
I don't think so. A lot of people were like, listen, like, what porn stars do, first of all, is legal. Second of all, porn stars provide entertainment. The end. So it's like especially hypocritical and disappointing for me coming from an entertainer, because you would think that they would get it. It's one thing for a politician to, like, clutch their pearls, but for an entertainer who, if you take this, like, warped moral imperialism out of the equation, it, like, is what Chelsea Handler does really that different from what pornographers do? I don't think so. In the terms of, like, creating media, the purpose of which is entertainment.
The thing that drives me crazy is this. So many people watch porn.
So many people watch porn.
So I don't know the numbers out of my head, but, like, so many people watch porn. Men, women, people of all genders watch porn.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And
lots of different kinds of porn, by the way.
Sure.
Lots of different kinds of porn.
Right. And we can talk about different kinds of porn, and I think we should, and I think we'll probably get into that shortly.
Yeah.
So, like, it's super normal to watch porn, and yet we treat the people who make porn, and specifically the people who are in front of the camera on porn.
Yes.
And I think specifically the women, right? Like,
yes, absolutely.
I think this is super gendered, as degraded by their participation in producing something that people really like. Like, and I think that it's really tied to our general cultural idea about sex as something that enhances a man's masculinity or affirms a man's masculinity, but degrades women, right? That sex itself is treated that way, that, like, oh, yeah, if a woman's had too many partners, like, she's degraded by that. And if a man's had a lot of partners, you know, like, I think that it's actually deeply gendered and is deeply, it's deeply part of the idea we have that women are degraded by sex in general.
Two things. Number one, you know, your point about the fact that most people have enjoyed or do frequently enjoy porn, I think is definitely undermined by the fact that most people's enjoyment probably comes coupled with shame and guilt for enjoying it. And so I think that a lot of where this hate and dehumanization comes from is a projection of the shame and guilt that people feel about their curiosity and desire to watch humans having sex. And if they can displace that shame onto the people that made it, who, you know, clearly the people who are making it have, like, if porn taints you, then obviously the people who are making it are more tainted than the people who are watching it, is like, goes the like shame logic.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The other part of it is that, you know, I tweeted this the other day, I think that there is this widespread idea that watching porn, any porn, you know, and people aren't specific, they're indiscriminate, they just say porn and we're supposed to know what that means. It's supposed to encompass like all videos ever made since the invention of the like camera, I guess, like I think that morally people feel very comfortable talking about it like it's a snuff film.
Yes.
That all porn is documented abuse, and that when you're watching porn, if you are turned on or excited by it, if you get any pleasure from it, if you enjoy it, if you feel compelled to watch it, if you think about it afterwards, that you are complicit in abuse, and you know often the drive to continue to watch it is so strong that then you have this, again, this like shame and desire get like coupled together, right? So I really just want to make it very clear that this concept of all porn being documented abuse is false. I'm not saying that abuse never happens within the adult film industry, or even that it's easy to distinguish between a scene that like violates someone's consent and a scene that doesn't. But the idea that you could, I mean, you're like throwing the porn stars out with the bathwater.
Well, you know? I think that also is tied toward our cultural imagination about women and sex, which is like that women ourselves, we do not like sex.
Right.
And so for a woman to be participating in porn, something terrible must have happened, right? Like that she's...
That's a really good point.
That there are a lot of people who cannot conceive that a woman might freely choose to participate in the production of porn, let alone enjoy it.
I think that's a really good point.
Because we're not supposed to like to have real sexual appetites in the first place, let alone something as considered sort of outré or sort of like as confrontationally sexual as putting it on film.
I mean, I think that this is a great segue into the New York Times Magazine cover story that we're going to talk about, because a lot of what made me really angry about this piece is that there is this persistent characterization of female porn stars as not experiencing pleasure. And, you know, it's not just limited to this one particular piece. I think that you see all the time people assuming that there's no way that she could be enjoying that, that it's all faked, or, you know, at best faked, at worst coerced. And that I have such complicated feelings about that. On one hand, I know for a fact that there is porn out there in which women are enjoying themselves and having orgasms and experiencing pleasure and doing things that they like. I just know that for a fact.
Sure.
But then on the other hand, there's this sort of false dichotomy within sex worker rights discourse that like you're either a trafficking victim or a happy hooker, right? And like the idea that in order for porn to be feminist or ethical, or in order for sex work to be feminist and ethical, you know, in order for, going back to Jack the Stripper, that every stripper has to feel empowered. I mean, this is very relevant to your work and the idea of faux empowerment, right? That in order for strippers and porn stars and dominatrixes and escorts to be deserving of human rights and respect for the work that they do, that they have to be empowered with every click of their high heels, and that they have to be having real authentic orgasms, and the pressure that we put on sex workers to represent that or perform that or meet that expectation is also fucked up.
Yeah, no, that sounds like crippling pressure. Like, I can't even, my partner and I barely celebrate Valentine's Day because, like, I can't take holidays where I'm supposed to feel a certain way.
Oh, yeah.
I just feel no, I like almost always, like, if we tried to do something on purpose super romantic on Valentine's Day, we would get in a fight because I'd be like, I don't feel the right way and I'm trying to fake it and blah, blah, blah. Like, it just, like, I can only imagine what that kind of pressure is to be like, I am authentically in my own pleasure at all time, but also I gotta make rent and we have this space for a certain amount of time.
I mean, I will tell you, you know, the gig, it's Valentine's Day. You know, I like went to the dentist and now I'm recording Unscrewed. So that feels like, you know, pretty well-rounded. But I have a gig tonight that's not strictly a sex work gig, but like I will totally like show up and perform like pleasure and love because I'm getting paid.
Yep.
I feel the exact same way about Valentine's Day and many other holidays, actually. I mean, I don't know, maybe part of the reason that I have such a low tolerance for that is that I have so much experience in sex work where, like, I was, like, very well compensated for doing emotional labor.
And so, like, now you're like, I'm supposed to do this emotional labor and you're not paying me?
Yeah, yeah. But no, I'm just not having it.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
So let's talk about the nitty-gritty, though, about this piece in case people haven't read it, because I don't want to, like, get too far into the weeds without grounding the conversation. So the New York Times ran this piece. I forget who the writer's name was.
Maggie Jones.
Okay, Maggie Jones. So this...
She's an MFA professor.
Mazel tov. Which is another one of my, like, fucking bugaboos, which is, like, everyone thinks that they can write and think about sex because they don't consider it a legitimate area of expertise, but...
Dude, you know that's an axe I'm grinding to, sister.
So she discovered that there was this porn literacy class happening, actually, here in Boston somewhere, and she went and spent time with some teenagers who were taking this porn literacy class. And it's sort of a meditation on what are teenagers learning about sex from where, and mostly it's from porn, and what does that mean, and what's happening in this class. And, you know, it was interesting. You texted me about it, and you were like, I feel like it could have been like a chapter in Unscrewed, my book, like, except my chapter would have been better.
By the way, I did say that. I mean, the sort of format of, like, the writer, you know, sitting in on the class, yes, and being like, this person is doing this sort of, like, cutting edge form of sex education, so I'm gonna, like, tell you what it's like to, like, be in this room.
But I also feel like she asked some good questions that I am also interested in and probably did address in Unscrewed, right? Like, what are teenagers learning about sex and from where? Like, what does it mean that we mostly let teenagers learn about sex from porn? How can we do better? Right? You know, like...
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the most frustrating things about this article is that it was disappointing because I'm sure that you and I have talked before about how, you know, porn gets scapegoated for many things that people perceive to be sexual ills in our society. But, you know, again, adult filmmakers are making entertainment for adults. Why is it their fault or their responsibility that kids are watching it and they don't have any pleasure-based education? They've never even like seen genitalia other than their own. They might not even have looked at their own genitalia, by the way. They like don't understand how people relate to each other. They like don't understand like what orgasms, you know, et cetera.
Well, and the crazy thing in this piece is like the porn literacy educators aren't allowed or like they don't want to rock the boat by actually teaching sex ed. And I thought that was like actually the most interesting moment. Like, we can accept porn literacy education, but we can't talk about sex ed. Like, and the thing that drives me crazy is like, I don't think all porn is morally neutral, right? Like, I think it's like any other medium, right? Like some of it's like misogynist and racist, and you know, like,
of course
there's some really damaging messages you can get from some porn, and a lot of it's the free stuff on the tube sites for reasons that I wrote about in my book and we could talk about for a whole other conversation, right? Like,
totally.
The medium itself, it's like saying, like, well, we need to educate kids about how to read novels.
Yeah.
But I think porn literacy education would be a good part of comprehensive sex education, right? Like, in the context of sex education, talking about some of these questions, and not in the way that they answer these questions, but, like, how does porn get made? Those angles aren't necessarily the most comfortable angles for humans to have sex in. They're good for the camera. Or, like, you know, like, these are oftentimes fantasies and, you know, like, understanding what you're consuming. I'm all for that. And I'm all for, like, even talking about, what do porn performers get paid? Do we think that's fair compensation? But the way it's presented in this piece, and I don't know how much that was the actual porn educators or how much it was the writer, it sounds like both, really, is like the fact that porn performers aren't well compensated means they're gross.
There are a few things that are in competition for the worst and most disturbing parts of this piece, but I think the clear winner is this section where these so-called porn literacy educators ask the teenagers in their class to pretend that they're contestants on a reality TV show. And then they describe a scenario in which you would kneel on the ground while someone poured a goopy substance over your face, and in another you would lick a spoon that had touched fecal matter. And these are supposed to be scenarios that make kids think, you know, would you do this thing? Okay, well, in porn, you know, one of the things that porn stars might do is have a bunch of people ejaculate on their faces. You know, that's like the goopy substance is supposed to become. And, you know, the other is the idea that sometimes in porn, someone will like suck a dick that has just been fucking an ass. And, you know, the idea is like, you know, that is like tantamount to like licking a like fecal matter covered spoon.
I mean, it is, in a way. Like, I actually think that's really unsanitary and unsafe.
You know, as an actual sex educator that on a monthly basis teaches, you know, develops curriculum and teaches sex positive workshops about things like anal sex and role play and dirty talk and spanking to adults, I absolutely advise people not to put something in their partner's ass and then put it in
anywhere else, really, without cleaning it,
really any other orifice. Like, I like, it's not something that is appealing to me in porn, but my tastes are like totally irrelevant. Like, the performers are making a risk aware assessment of what they want to portray.
Well, and I think even more than that, like, it's a missed opportunity. Like, I feel like that example is used to paint all anal sex as icky.
Well, absolutely.
And instead, they could be having a nuanced conversation about, like, porn performers might be taking heightened risks to make the porn extra exciting, and they're doing it under these conditions if they're, you know, if it's a good set. And, you know, like, what do we think about translating that to our own lives, right? Like, I feel like the thing that drives me up a wall about the way porn is talked about is all the missed opportunities for real legitimate conversations about porn and sex. I mean, also, obviously, the dehumanization and the risk to sex workers, which I want to talk more about. But, like, I feel like this piece just kept getting super close to, like, real conversations that are good to have, and then going with porn is icky, sex is icky.
I agree with that exactly. And the educator that is being profiled, you know, is quoted here as saying, when you understand it's not just two people on the screen, but an industry, it's not as sexy. And I just, you know, I find that opinion to be intellectually dishonest.
Yeah, it's weird.
And it feels connected to this idea that gets perpetuated sometimes that, like, porn is better when it is made by amateurs who are in real relationships, and that you're, like, watching, and that you're, you know, if you're watching, you know, two people who are a real couple making love, that is... that's better than porn, where it's an industry and there are some regulations, there is some culture, there is, you know, also professionals who are prepared to, you know, make risk aware assessments and who understand that there are stigma risks of being seen in porn and just, like, all of these different things, you know. Like, it's so weird because it's like, I feel that if more people understood what it's really like to work in the adult film industry, that they would make these generalizations less often, and that they would fall back on their sort of boogeyman scapegoat confirmation bias less. And yet this attitude is like, we don't even want to know what the pragmatics of the industry are like, because that makes it less sexy. Like,
well, and there really is real stuff to talk about the porn industry. The porn industry is not a utopia either, but
we
never get to have those real conversations if we go like, oh, this whole thing over here is ick.
Exactly.
I want you to talk a little bit more about why amateur porn, real couple porn, is not better. I agree with you, but I want to make sure that comes through.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Fuck it. You had me on your show to sit on my hobby horse, so I'm hobbying the horse.
Ride the hobby horse, honey. You ride that horse.
One of the people who gets an extensive section of this article is a woman named Cindy Gallup.
Yes.
Who is like a venture capitalist tech person who has made a website called Make Love, Not Porn.
Just the title of which makes me crazy.
It makes me crazy. And, you know, the funny thing about Cindy Gallup, I have mixed feelings about Cindy Gallup. I sort of feel like her entire mission is, like, antithetical to mine. And yet I do think that she is a... What's up, Cindy, if you're listening? I do think that she is an intelligent and powerful businesswoman who...
She knows what she's doing when it comes to business, for sure.
She knows what she's doing. And honestly, I think that I could probably learn a lot from her.
Sure.
And quite a lot of us who are out here trying to get a lot of our ideas about porn and love and sex across, I feel like we could all benefit from one another, and maybe I'll try to make that happen. But anyway, Cindy somehow always gets so much space, and she tells the same story.
It's respectability.
I think it is respectability. I think she's positioned herself.
Yep.
And then people feel like they've spoken to someone who's involved in the adult industry, even though she's not a pornographer.
Well, and she deliberately sets herself apart from the industry. Her literally Make Love, Not Porn, she sets her project up in opposition to the porn industry.
That's right. And basically what Make Love, Not Porn is a site where anyone can upload their sex tapes, basically. It's marketed as, you know, very successfully, I will add, marketed as a place where you can watch real couples having real sex. And the premise of her entire website and her entire business is, in my mind, fundamentally whorephobic, but also just the idea, I mean, this goes back to your original question, just the idea that amateur videos made by people who don't necessarily understand filmmaking, don't necessarily understand lighting, editing, framing, continuity, that you laugh, but these things matter. And to say nothing of understanding how to have sex in a performative way on camera, which is just a huge skill set. And, you know, some people do it in a way that has nothing to do with their own sexuality and just think of it purely as a performance. Some people are very much able to be present and, you know, making a human connection and experiencing pleasure and having sex while also making that internal experience external for the camera. The idea that like these amateurs, you know, are making porn that is like more like morally responsible for you to be watching than these people who are professionals is bananas to me. And it's just wrong. It's just wrong.
Well, like, and the assumption that you can't be coerced or abused into making amateur porn, like the idea that it's somehow more ethical, that somehow because these people know each other, that they must be treating each other ethically, flies in the face of everything we know about how relationships work.
Hello. And by the way, maybe a lot of those people are like, oh, let's do this thing that would be like spicy and sexy. And, you know, they don't necessarily like, you know, need to do it to make the money, you know, and then they're like contributing to the devaluing of the expectation that people would have that some of us are like trying to make our living off of doing this kind of performance, right?
Yeah.
You know, but also if they're not really sort of thinking about it as like a professional move or even like a fine art move, you know, not even thinking like I am like doing this thing as like, you know, part of my like performance art life, that they're like not really thinking about like the stigma or consequences of like how they could be affected by people seeing that video.
Yeah. I don't know how she's guaranteeing that there's not, like, revenge porn up there or, like, somebody who's like, let's make this tape. It'll just be us. And then it winds up, you know what I mean? Like, there's so many ethical issues with it.
Thank you.
But because she calls it making love, you know, not porn, and because she's, like, a well-off older white lady, you know, who's good at business, which absolutely I agree. She is good at business and I would like to learn things from her. The idea that this is inherently more ethical, it just drives me around the bend.
I was going to rant more, but I'm not going to.
I want you, before we wrap it up, you were on Twitter talking about how it feels when, you know, like this article or Cindy Gallup talk about real people in opposition to porn performers.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of gets to the heart of the damage that this kind of dehumanization and othering does when we talk about the porn industry as sort of a monolithic bad and a monolithic other, monolithically degrading and all of those things. And I wonder if you could, I'm sure there are people listening who just literally have never thought about this before.
Yeah.
What is the impact? The impact on sex workers, on people in the porn industry, of the sort of bankruptcy and damage of our current discourse around porn.
Yeah, you know, another quote from this piece that I posted on Instagram was one of the educators saying, most people are having sex with real people, not porn stars. And I, you know, it's connected to what I was saying before about how amazing I think Jack the Stripper's work is of just like making these like cute, well-designed shirts that say strippers are people. It seems glib, but the reason that we need to put it on shirts and keep repeating it is that the psychological toll of seeing in, you know, respectable journalism, people getting away with saying that these people aren't real people is, you know, First of all, another piece that I wrote for Rolling Stone recently was about a porn star named August Ames who took her own life a couple of months ago. And, you know, it was, of course, very sad and a tragedy. And her death has sparked a lot of conversation about mental health within the adult film industry. And, you know, the fact that basically all pornographers are independent contractors who don't have health insurance and may not even fully grasp what the effects of stigma are going to be like in their life, because, you know, banks discriminate against pornographers, families disown and exile their, you know, their family members when they find out that they have been in porn. I could tell you a million stories about that, recent stories, not stories from the 70s, things that are happening as we speak. And dehumanization makes people susceptible to violence, and that trickles down to the most vulnerable among us. For example, trans women of color who may be doing sex work in riskier environments because that is what's available to them. If people don't think of them as real people, then they feel they can treat them however they want with impunity.
Yeah, I mean, I actually saw a piece yesterday making the rounds, I think Time ran it, which was kind of great, about sex workers and Me Too, and sex workers who've tried to speak out and say, Me Too, I've also experienced sexual abuse on the job. And people saying to them, well, you, how can you be raped if you're a whore?
Yeah, well, I mean, I could go on and on and on. I've done a lot of really disturbing and demoralizing research about legal precedent being set by cases and lawyers and judges, yeah, saying that a sex worker can't be raped by virtue of what she's doing, or treating that someone could be only tried for theft of property. It's stomach churning, and it's true. And, you know, it's both the real physical violence and also psychological and emotional violence that we have to deal with from the world, from strangers and families and potential other employers and intimate partners and everything. But it's also the internalized fear and hatred that we carry around with us. The reason that I get so emotional and so worked up and so upset about these things that someone might be like, well, did they really mean that, is that I see the harm that it causes to the people that I love and to my colleagues and the people in my communities, many of whom are queer, many of whom are POC, many of whom are lower class, working class. And, you know, we're struggling to make ends meet and express ourselves the same as any other human on this planet.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to stand for it.
Yes. Thank you. I know that was probably a lot.
Well, you know, I mean, I have an enormous amount of privilege as a sex worker and have had personally mostly very positive experiences as a sex worker. So I feel like I have a lot of bandwidth and a lot of spoons, as they say, in the mental health care community. I have a lot of spoons to talk about these things. So I feel like it's my responsibility to do so, like as worked up and upset and as personally as I take all of this, I've really have the privilege of a lot of resilience. So, but I also do what I can to take care of myself. So
I appreciate you sharing it with me and with Unscrewed Nation.
I appreciate you, Jacqueline.
Aww.
Yeah. And by the way, please, let's get you writing these cover stories and getting these paychecks and giving people a voice, because you just wrote an incredible book, Unscrewed.
Bless you.
Available now. wherever fine books are sold. You know, that really demonstrates that you're able to investigate these kinds of programs and these kinds of social issues, but talk about them in a way that doesn't just like lean on this like shaming confirmation bias. So we, you know, I want you to work more, and I want more people like you out there telling these stories.
I would also like that. Unscrewed Nation, we want to hear from you. I know that this probably is confusing. It's probably some new ideas if you haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about the discourse we have culturally around porn. What other questions do you have? What feels challenging to you? I'm totally here to chat about it. Hit me up on Twitter. Use the hashtag unscrewed at me, JACLYNF as in Friedman. You can also email me privately. You can send it to unscrewed@JacquelineFriedman.com. Friedman is FRIEDMAN. Tina, do you want to be in on this conversation?
Oh, yes, I would love that. I am both on Twitter and Instagram as at Tina Horn Sass, which is TinaHornSass.
Or it's Tina Horn's ass.
Listen, it's whatever you want it to be.
And where else can people follow your work in general?
Well, I would love it if people would subscribe to my podcast.
Yes, it's so good.
Thank you. It's called Why Are People Into That? It is every episode I have a different guest and we discuss a subject of sex, kink, gender, and love. Yeah, so I would love it if people would subscribe. I would love it if people would hit me up on that social media. My website is tinahorn.net, which is TINAHORN.net. And I do have a Patreon. I very much appreciate support of my work, and that is patreon.com/TINAHORN.
Swell. And you can find me on Twitter, as I mentioned, Jacqueline F. Instagram is Jacqueline Effable. It is not Jacqueline Fable. I just want you to read it the one way. I am less flexible on that than Tina is. And obviously you can find all my stuff, including all my books, as well as articles, upcoming appearances. I've got a bunch of dates coming up this spring, info on how to book me, to bring me to your community. All of that is at JacquelineFriedman.com. So hit me up. And also make sure you're subscribed to the show if you're just listening for the first time, or if you just pop in now and again. We do a lot of good episodes, and I have a good feeling about this upcoming season. We have a lot to talk about. So go into Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Acast, wherever you like to get your podcasts. Make sure you subscribe. And while you're in there, give me 5 stars. Give me a little review. It really helps people to find the show. And I really appreciate it. It makes me happy. Unscrewed is produced and edited by yours truly, Jacqueline Friedman. Our in and out music is by the Pink Tiles. And our cover art is by Nicole Dodonna and was developed in collaboration with The Establishment, who also developed the sound cues. Until next week, I am wishing you safe and happy sex lives.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's JUVEDERM.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.